Hello, this is Simon Wegriff, creator of the iFleet Heart Rate Variability app that tells you when to train, how hard to train and when to rest. Today I'm delighted to be talking to doctor, coach and author Dr. Phil Maffetone. Phil's an internationally recognised expert on health, nutrition and human performance. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, Simon. Great to be with you.
Thank you. So, Phil, you've been practicing health and nutrition and endurance sports coaching for very many years now. And currently there's a lot of talk, almost fever pitch talk, on low carbohydrate, high fat diets. But I think you're credited with having discovered this kind of diet decades ago. So how did you come across low-carb, high-fat diets, and when did you start using it? And what problem were you trying to solve by introducing this diet?
Well, it's interesting to see in the last, 3-4 years, the explosion of interest from all areas, certainly in sports, the healthcare across the board. The healthcare interest in low carbohydrate, high fat, what they call diets, and I don't like referring to it as a diet because that's not what it is. But it's something that has exploded, and as you mentioned, I've been using it for years, beginning when I got into practice in 1977. But I was exposed to it several years before that. I want to say 1973 maybe, or 72, I went on a, for health reasons, a fast that was about 2 weeks, just water, of course. That's what a fast really is.
Yeah.
And I had read about ketosis, and I was just interested in doing that, and I did, and it was the first time I experienced the incredible energy that one gets in this state of nutritional ketosis, and it was a valuable experience for me from a health standpoint, and I never forgot it, and began to use various types of nutritional approaches by manipulating dietary macronutrients, especially fats and carbohydrates. Think of fats and carbohydrates as a seesaw with protein in the middle. So as we make adjustments in the diet, we increase and decrease fats and carbohydrates accordingly, keeping protein about the same. And that's a good view and good way to approach it. But I began seeing that not only patients who had certain illnesses or were diagnosed with diseases responding to that, but athletes as well. And it was a tough period to make those suggestions, because it was the boom of high carbohydrate, and of course fats were bad, so it was low fats. Protein was bad, and low protein was prevalent, and so there were athletes that I was seeing who were eating diets that were 70-80% carbohydrate sometimes. And you see that today, not as much, but, 60% carbohydrate was sort of typical. And I wanted to bring everyone down to at least 40%. And I saw the results from a health standpoint. People were more energetic. They were less hungry. They were more satisfied with their meals. Their energy levels were higher. Their intestinal function was better. And for the athletes, it was the same beneficial effects in training from an energy standpoint. And basically, if you have more energy, your muscles can do more work. So it it was a valuable thing to experience that initial fast and how good I felt, and then applying it to athletes and sedentary people alike, it was quite a valuable thing.
Mm. And although perhaps in some quarters the adoption of nutrition, which is taking the seesaw in the other direction to what most people would consider a normal or even healthy diet with lots of carbohydrates in, to almost another extreme where you almost starve the body of carbohydrates. Do you think that this mode of operation is something that's was originally developed perhaps during human evolution as a way of dealing with scarcity of certain food sources seasonally, and an adjustment that took place very naturally, perhaps to move from berries perhaps that were available in the autumn to stored supplies of nuts and other things like that, and shortages of carbohydrates at certain times of year? Do you think that mechanism is something that we've always had but which has been neglected?
Oh, without a doubt. That's why I don't like to call it a diet. It's not a diet. It's how humans have always eaten. And it's not so much that, we ate this way when carbohydrates were scarce. Carbohydrates were not readily available, other than the occasional stumbling on a beehive and getting honey. Concentrated carbohydrates basically didn't exist. I mean, we had root vegetables, but in terms of those high concentrates of carbohydrate foods, they didn't exist. So I think it's a uniquely human way of eating, and that's how we should look at it. I also think that today, and for the past only couple of hundred years, certainly the past 50 years, there's been a massive amount of extremely refined carbohydrates that have come into the marketplace. And of course, if you own a company that makes carbohydrate foods of various sorts, or if you're in the sugar industry, you're going to want to promote your product, and you do it by making it appealing from a taste standpoint, but also from a nutrition standpoint. So when they say, well, sugar is what we use for energy, it's really kind of silly, because we can get a lot more energy from fat. It's a much more efficient and effective energy, especially for endurance athletes. When we talk about, having a certain amount of carbohydrate in the diet, we always have to talk about the fact that these are natural, healthy carbohydrates like fruits, and not refined carbohydrates. I think today, and this is also a relatively new thing, surprisingly, shockingly, that there, I think, is basically a consensus now across the board with people who are not affiliated with industry, that eating refined carbohydrates and junk food is something that nobody should ever do. And so, and we're not talking about, what do we do in the middle of an Ironman triathlon? That's the exception. But in the daily eating routine, refined carbohydrates, including processed flours and sugars, for example, just have no place.
Right. And that's primarily due to the insulin response that we get following the ingestion of those kind of refined carbohydrates.
Right. That's one of the important factors that affect us in a negative way, health-wise and fitness-wise, because what insulin does when we increase it too much by eating refined carbohydrates is it turns down our fat-burning mechanism. So now our endurance energy is reduced significantly, and we're forced to use more sugar as an energy source. And of course, sugar is quite limited And so our aerobic system is impaired when we consume refined carbohydrates. And, people often talk about the need for carbohydrates during a marathon or during whatever event. The fact is we use our aerobic system primarily, not our anaerobic system, in even a 5K race. And the use of fat as fuel is very significant, even at race pace. So we're still burning fat at those high intensity levels of training or racing. And if we don't, then we tend to use up our glycogen stores quicker. And of course, everyone knows what that happens. We hit the wall in the marathon. We get off our bike in a triathlon and just don't have the energy to move as fast as we want, etc.
Right, absolutely. And I think not that many people realize how limited our glycogen stores are. But, if we're exercising fairly vigorously, those really are used up almost completely within about an hour and a half. And lots of people are doing events considerably longer than that, from half marathon, marathon, various lengths of triathlon. So fat burning is not an option. And we've got, an almost unlimited store of fat. So what we need to do as part of training for endurance events is to ensure that we can use those effectively.
Right, and even a lean runner has enough fat stored to run about 600 miles. But with sugar, if we're relying strictly on sugar, you're only talking about a few minutes worth of energy. To go an hour and a half, you have to assume that there's fat burning because you don't have an hour and a half worth of stored glycogen. Even if you're producing lactate, which is an important source of glucose as well, but technically it's just a few minutes. What's important is people need to get away from this idea that glucose is our primary fuel, or is a lot of people think it's our only fuel, and of course it's not true. We use both fat and sugar, and the key is to balance that and use in endurance sports, certainly use as much body fat for fuel as possible, and it'll give us the best return.
I think a number of people have some understanding that fats can fuel muscular work, but I think there's a fair number of people who think that the brain runs exclusively on glucose, and of course that's not really the case, is it?
It's not. We could use ketones, which we produce all the time, mostly from fats. We could use ketones as a brain fuel, and that indeed has been for 100 years or more a very important therapy in patients with seizures, changing the fuel in the brain from glucose to ketones seems to have quite a therapeutic effect. And today there are many, many uses of nutritional ketosis, including cancer, certainly weight loss. In sports, we are finally starting to see the research come in. I'm presenting some information next week at a conference about a triathlete that I worked with who improved dramatically in 2015 because she shifted into a ketogenic plan with her diet, and it reduced her need for, this is one example, it reduced her need for food during the Ironman from about 400 calories an hour to about 130 calories an hour. Pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And all this was taking place while she was running her best Ironman. She had three Ironman races, did quite well, ran two of them as a PR. And this is a woman who's been doing this for 12 or 13 years or so. So a very experienced Ironman competitor, all of a sudden at age 38 is running her best races on ketones and burning a high amount of fat.
Right. That's certainly impressive. And I read a paper recently, I think Jeff Volek was a lead author on it, that indicated that elite level ultra runners and triathletes who've been practicing a low carb, high fat regime for about half a year were managing on average almost 2.5 times the peak fat oxidation of similarly, you know, genetically endowed athletes who'd been practicing a more traditional high carb, low fat diet. And I did a quick calculation that came to about 650 calories an hour, which is, you know, it's quite an impressive is already, you know, quite an impressive work rate. So, you know,
right, yeah, right, it is, and it's good to see those kinds of studies. We knew about this decades ago, and you know, there's something about being a clinician and being out there in the trenches working with athletes. You come up with these kinds of ideas, and all you can do is tell people about it, and of course they, you know, they think you're pretty crazy. But once the scientists start measuring and publishing these findings, then the level of acceptance goes up, and we're seeing that today. In the last few years, we've been seeing that, and it's nothing new to those of us who've been doing it. But it's nice to see a lot of people coming on board and accepting it.
Mm. Would it also be true, Phil, to say that burning fats as fuels during exercise creates less free radicals and oxidative stress than using carbohydrates?
I think that's a good point, and I think you're exactly right. Is you're gonna affect your body chemistry in more ways than just having more energy. And the oxidative stress, which is a big problem with athletes, it contributes to overtraining, and it's the reason many athletes have immune stress. They frequently are sick. For example, the common cold, or the, you know, for a while the runner's virus was considered normal, kind of a silly idea, but you know, the frequency of runners getting sick was actually considered part of the game. And so, yeah, you're right. I think there's an across-the-board benefit with not just the immune system and free radical balance, but I think other systems of the body where health and fitness will be balanced. And they're two different things. And part of the free radical problem comes from training and training intensity, and people who train with too high an intensity will tend to have more free radicals.
Right. Okay. My daily obsession for the past 5 years or so has been heart rate variability, and starting with the iFleet app, of which you were a generous supporter way back in 2010, I think. So what do you think we could expect athletes to see in heart rate variability, perhaps during and after they make a transition to a more ketogenic or a higher fat diet?
Well, I think when you make that transition, when you remove the stress of especially refined carbohydrates, but when you remove the insulin stress, you're going to reduce significantly the amount of stress in the body. And if we look at stress from a holistic standpoint, the stress can be physical, it can be biochemical, and it can be mental and emotional. And just removing the dietary stress and normalizing insulin and increasing fat burning and reducing reliance on glycogen stores, for example, is a huge stress that's going to affect the brain. And the brain responds to stress by regulating the body in certain ways. And when the brain has a lot of stress, it has to stimulate the pituitary, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and the autonomic nervous system has to adjust, and we end up having more sympathetic stress and less parasympathetic stress. And this is easily seen in heart rate variability, and people who have used that know how that mechanism works. But that's a very, very important stress-related mechanism that the body uses. Of course, the physical training fits right into that as well. But just making a change from high refined carbohydrates to eliminating those refined carbohydrates and moderating whatever, you know, the reason there's no diet is because everybody's different. And generally speaking, younger people are more insulin sensitive, so they will usually fare better when they're consuming a little bit more natural carbohydrate. And with aging, insulin sensitivity changes, we become more insulin resistant, and that means we generally have to reduce the amount of natural carbohydrate we consume to maintain that good level of fat burning. But when those changes are made, you should just automatically see a change with heart rate variability, a change in that autonomic balance, and it's reflective of the significant stress and the reduction of it in the food choices.
Thanks. That's really interesting. There's been some research in very recent times, as I'm sure you're aware, on the parasympathetic branch of the nervous system actually modulating the inflammation reaction. And that inflammation reaction is tied to one of the last points we made about oxidative stress. So if oxidative stress is reduced, then there might be less signaling going on for an inflammation reaction, which would also perhaps lead to less variability in HRV with long training sessions, for instance.
Right, right. You know, we can isolate the diet in sports and look at the things it does or does not do. We could do the same with training, but they all kind of work together. And inflammation is a very, very important component, because if we train too hard and don't recover, one of the things that happens is our inflammatory mechanisms kick in and we have too much inflammation. But the diet will do that just as well, just as easily. For example, insulin will drive the omega-6 fats, all those cascades that we talk about in biochemistry, into the inflammatory instead of the anti-inflammatory pathway. So consuming sugar and refined carbohydrate increases inflammation. And of course, inflammation is not only part of the overtraining syndrome, not only part of injuries, anything that ends with itis, such as plantar fasciitis, arthritis, Achilles tendonitis, those are inflammatory conditions, mostly chronic ones.
Right.
And the diet can do that, and the training can, and it'll reflect in the heart rate variability.
Okay, very cool. It seems to me from reading the experiences of some other people who've gone through the transition that they had quite a hard time for 2 or 3 weeks when going from probably a reasonably healthy regular diet, because these are quantified self type of people, through to true ketosis, and they're measuring like either breath acetone levels or they're doing blood tests every morning. How difficult is this transition, and are there ways in which we can make it easier?
Sure. You hear about all of these negative side effects that people get, but you hear the same thing in any situation where a person changes what they're doing on a day-to-day basis. So if you go on a low-fat diet, if you go on a low-calorie diet, if you go on all the diets that have come and gone over the years, you have to go through a transition. You have to adapt to that. The body, especially the gut, our intestine does not like change. And if you change, significantly change, especially your eating habits, your gut's going to rebel and your body's going to rebel a little bit until it can adjust to the new foods, the new eating style. And the same thing happens when we cut back on refined carbohydrates and total carbohydrates. The additional stress that we see with reductions in carbohydrates is that many people are addicted to sugar. Mm-hmm. They're truly addicted, not unlike cocaine, heroin, mm-hmm. nicotine, even caffeine. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to changing the foods that one is consuming, going through that addiction, going through the withdrawal of that sugar addiction is going to be another factor. But that often can just take a few days to really go through, and it could take a few months or a few years to get to the point where if you're walking by a bakery, you don't enjoy the aroma. You're actually offended by it. But in the beginning, to not get up in the middle of the night and search for that big bag of cookies you have hidden away, that could just take a few days. And I've developed something called the two-week test, which helps people go through that. And over a two-week period, it seems most people will be able to make the transition fairly easily. And the big problem with making these changes for the average person is they say, okay, I'm gonna cut back on my refined carbohydrates, and I'll do this 2 week test and not have any beans or lentils or bread or whatever. And but then they don't realize that they've got to put back some fat in the diet, that seesaw phenomenon. Yeah. Otherwise, they're gonna be literally deficient in calories, and for an athlete, that can be devastating. So as long as you're balancing your diet, when you reduce the carbohydrates, you add the fats, the healthy fats back in, and in a two-week period, most people can go through that process and start burning ketones in a higher levels of ketones that are measurable. And I like the breath test. You can do it by blood. It's a better one, but it's not practical for most people.
Right. Okay. So, when we think about restricting carbohydrates, does that include common vegetables like broccoli and carrots and things like that, because they've got a lot of fiber in them, and that fiber is cellulose, basically, and cellulose gets broken down into the body into a carbohydrate ultimately, doesn't it? Or is that not quite right?
Well, but we don't have cellulase in the human body, so we don't break down cellulose much. But if we consume enough vegetables, we're gonna be consuming some carbohydrates. And the only vegetables I like to restrict are potatoes, because they're a very they could be a high glycemic vegetable.
Does that include sweet potatoes or not? Sweet potatoes, okay.
Well, I personally don't eat sweet potatoes, but many people who are on a ketogenic eating plan can have a very, very small amount. Everybody's a little different. And I think the bottom line is you have to eat vegetables. And so you want to do it in a way that you're not going to get so much carbohydrate that your ketone production is reduced. So you can have 6, 7, 8 servings of vegetables a day and still be in nutritional ketosis. Whether you can have sweet potatoes or not is another thing. Some people may be able to have small amounts, most probably not.
Okay. In some of the articles I've read and papers and things, they talk about restricting carbohydrates to 10% of daily calories. Do you think that's a good target number for everybody, or would you say it varies? And if it varies, how can you find the optimum level for you for an individual?
It certainly varies. I think you know, that's it varies, and what people need to do is experiment. That's the bottom line. And they should experiment by truly experimenting, trying this, trying that, measuring their ketones, and evaluating their signs and symptoms. Look at, for example, fatigue as a very important symptom. We should be energetic from the moment we wake up until we get into bed to sleep at night. Right. We shouldn't be hungry all the time. We shouldn't be hungry at all. I hardly ever get hungry. We shouldn't be craving carbohydrates or caffeine, which is really related to fatigue. And so use all the signs and symptoms to monitor your diet and translate all of that into feeling. I know when I'm in a higher state of ketosis because I just feel it, because I've been doing this for so long. I know what it's like. I sort of make this transition into a state where I'm in ketosis at a much higher level. And that's what people need to do. They need to understand what it feels like to have that perfect balance of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins.
Sounds really good. And a worthwhile goal. And then finally, Phil, is this? Do you think this is a practice that everybody can potentially benefit from, or are there people, for instance, people who have certain medical conditions who really shouldn't attempt to go through this transition?
Well, I think if someone has a medical condition, they need to find a health practitioner that they could work with. If you have a health practitioner and you go and say, look, I have this condition, but I want to try nutritional ketosis. And he or she says, you know, oh, I don't do that, or I don't know anything about it, or you shouldn't change anything. You should just stay the course. Find somebody else, because in many cases, a diabetic, for example, or a patient with high blood pressure, these conditions are, you know, these patients respond extremely well to a ketogenic eating plan, to the point where, and I've seen this for decades, where you could get them off medication. Not a difficult thing to do. People who have too much body fat, look at making a modification in your diet so that you can reduce that body fat. And if a healthcare professional can assist you, that's great. But if not, you're on your own. But I think what's happening today, and this conference I'm going to next week, is going to have a number of speakers who have been researching nutritional ketosis in relation to a number of conditions, cancer being one, of course, diabetes and weight loss and a number of others. So I think you're seeing seizures as well. I think you're seeing more and more medical conditions being hooked up with a nutritional ketogenic plan showing great benefits.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And I was just thinking, when you were making some of those remarks about conditions like diabetes, seems that Professor Tim Noakes is on the receiving end of quite a bit of public yes. Debate and criticism for making very similar comments. So,
well, it's been great to see his crusade. I've known of Tim's work ever since his very first published paper in, I think it was 1980 or 79, when he published a paper on heart disease in marathon runners. And of course, back then, you didn't use those two ideas in the same sentence, heart disease and marathon runners. You know, running a marathon was supposed to protect you from not just heart disease, but everything. You know, back then, the running boom you know, it was almost it was a frenzy, you know, where running was the cure-all for everything. But Tim wrote this this study, and it was the first time I heard of Tim Noakes. And he was telling me about presenting the paper. He wanted to present it at a conference, and they wouldn't let him. And he finally convinced them, and so they slotted him in for his presentation during the coffee break.
Wow.
So
it didn't it clearly didn't put him off though.
No, it didn't, and that's his style, and he continues doing that. And I was so happy to see years ago when he realized that the carbohydrate problem was truly a problem, and he not only made personal changes, but he's been, of course, recommending avoiding it, avoiding the refined and lowering the carbohydrate content and ketosis and so forth. So it's good to see all these people coming on board.
Right. Thank you very much for that, Phil. That was brilliant. I presume that anybody that wants to find out more about your work and about practicing some of these techniques can do so either by visiting your website, philmaffetone.com, or indeed by reading one of your many books on health and fitness and athletic development.
Sure, the website has, probably 200 articles on this type of information, and the big book for athletes, the big book of endurance training and racing is the most recent one.
Yeah, certainly familiar with that one. Okay, thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you, Simon.